Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom of Faith. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight.
Hello, this is the Gist of Freedom. You're listening to Leslie Gist. I apologize for the technical difficulty, but Gloria Brown Marshall is certainly worth the trouble. Miss Brown Marshall, would you tell us a little bit about your book? You have an exciting book out, and I just want to talk about your book, and then we could go into the Trayvon Martin case and then also the stop and frisk.
Okay, well, my book is Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to Present, and it is a book that has chapters on race and education, as well as race and voting rights, property rights, and criminal justice. It also goes into race and internationalism, as well as property rights. It starts in the 1600s and goes to present, and it shows how the laws that were put in place during that time period are affecting us to this day and how we ended up in the situation we're in right now when it comes to race relations.
Great. Now, out of all the books you could have written, in the topics, why did you choose this particular topic?
Well, my background is as a civil rights litigator. And so I was working on civil rights cases in the Deep South, Alabama and Georgia. And what I realized was as I was meeting with those black parents, trying to come up with strategies in law and trying to get a good education for their children, I thought about how long we as black people have been working together, fighting, trying to get the law to do what it's supposed to do, and how many people had invested in the legal system. And it was during that time period I started researching. I went back a few generations, and then I was in the 1800s, and then I realized that we had been working as civil rights activists, as advocates, pressing, pushing, trying to get the system to do right and give us the type of justice we're supposed to receive for hundreds of years. So that's why my book is titled Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to Present. Yeah, because 1607 is where I begin and I go to present.
Okay. And what was the significance about 1607?
1607 is the founding of the Jamestown Colony in Jamestown, Virginia. And so I began there because that's when American law begins, because we built this country in American law based on English law that was in place with the Virginia colony. The Virginia colony was the first English colony in North America. So that's the colony that started the United States. So people think the United States started in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, but it actually started with the law anyway, based on English law, and we adopted those laws and started to use those laws, and then we developed our own laws after that.
Okay. So your book, how can someone purchase this book?
Well, it's available on Amazon.com, or you can go to our website, and that's lawandpolicygroup.org, and Law and Policy Group, and you have to spell out the word and, but lawandpolicygroup.org, and you can buy it on our website. Or you can also give donations on our website, just to make sure we know that. But you could also buy it on Amazon, and you can ask for it at your bookstores if they don't have it.
Okay. And this policy group, tell us a little bit more about the policy group.
Well, it was founded in 2005. And basically the group was... is initiated in 2001, and we've received our 501c3 status, and from there we have worked to develop policies and such for people who want to work in the area of advocacy around issues involving black women, children, and other people of color, and to look at these issues and be a weekend warrior. So you may not want to do this work all the time, but if you want to participate, you can. And one of the ways in which you can participate is through volunteering with our organization. We also published the report on the status of black women and girls.
Wonderful. Now, not only are you an attorney and a professor, but you also have some credentials as a playwright.
Yes, actually, I am a playwright, and I've had 7 produced plays, and my most recent play is Diversity, and it's a play that speaks to the family, and as a matter of fact, diversity, and not just the family, but in how you choose your mate for marriage and what goes into that choice.
Well, you have to be clear with marriage now that we have redefined what it means.
That's why it's called Diversity.
Okay.
So it looks at different aspects of marriage choices and what it means to be married today.
Now, I'm just curious, but with the gay marriage that Obama just signed, and all the, you know, with this the new attention he brought to this subject. What's the difference between what he's doing and what was done in the past? Wasn't it always a civil marriage between people of the same sex? Or what rights have they gained civilly that they didn't have before?
Well, I think it's a matter of recognition. There has been progress made as far as same-sex marriage, but not every state recognizes same-sex marriage. As a matter of fact, a number of states have legislation that recognizes marriage as only between a man and a woman. So
civilly speaking, what can a gay marriage, you know, what are they being deprived of civilly?
Oh, well, I think there are different levels, and it's not that I'm an expert on gay marriage, but what I think the people I've discussed this with are looking at is, one, they want their marriage to have all of the respect that a marriage between heterosexuals would have. And, of course, as you know, the NAACP has come out in support of gay marriage and this sense that it should be marriage by law, recognized as marriage as any other marriage would be recognized, and they don't want it to be just a marriage by simple contract. I think they want more of acceptance as their relationship between two sexes is equal in love and respect as the marriage between people of different sexes.
But that's a question of morality?
Some people have said it's a question of morality. Some people have said it's a question of social acceptance. And other people have said it's a question of law. And the question of law is, and this is what I know most, is that under the law, different states have recognized it, such as Vermont, Massachusetts, have recognized in New York that two people of different of the same sex can be married. And that they have the rights under law of inheritance and property division, the rights in a medical situation, that they are the ones who, if the spouse is on life support, it's the other spouse who decides if the plug is going to be pulled or not. These are, you know, if there is an adoption, you know, it's the other spouse deciding this. If it is a civil union, then there can be certain rights that are given that other rights may not be given. They all have to be spelled out. Insurance policies. Some insurance policies will say the partner, and is that an unmarried partner? I remember there at the time when people used to live together and never thought that living together was a sin, you know, and the person they lived with was not covered by insurance. So then the question becomes, when does a hanging out living together become serious enough to be considered a marriage. And if it's not serious enough to be considered a marriage, then it's not going to have all those rights and protections that would come under law. And that then becomes a concern, and that's why a number of gay people want to have not just the all the different aspects of marriage and not just those legal aspects, but also the sense that their marriage is as right and as true and as respectful as any other marriage. But here's the big glitch here, and this is a big but. One of them is that, you know, or I should say a big however, one of those things is that if a person who's married in one state, such as New York, that recognizes gay marriage, if they are to go to another state, their marriage is not recognized there. Whereas a marriage between heterosexuals is recognized worldwide. So think about this. When you go as a married couple to another country, you don't have to have your marriage certificate with you. If you're married in Idaho, you're still married in India. Whereas a gay person who's married to another person of the same sex is only recognized as being married in the state that recognizes gay marriage. So all the pitfalls that come from somebody not having a recognized marriage, all those things come into play when that person leaves the state.
Last question, so, I want to move on. How do they determine whose last name they're going to take?
I think it's anybody. I remember, you know, a heterosexual couple married, they made up their last name. They used the first part of her last name, the last part of his last name. When it comes to names, now you know in this country, when it comes to names, you can call yourself just about anything. So,
okay.
I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow's child is named Apple. So,
but I mean, the last name, they can't, so they just divide up their last names and merge them together?
You can name it. You can anything. As long as you two agree on it, you know, you can name anybody whatever they, you know, you name it, that's your name. But the legal part of it is once that name is established, then you have to make sure of the legal record that that is the name that's on the legal record.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. So that's once it's established, then you go through those same things to make sure that you're legally recognized by that name. But I think the concern is, one, the legality of having a relationship that's recognized by law. Because in very quickly, you know, a marriage is a contract.
Mm-hmm.
And if the law doesn't recognize the people in the contract, for example, someone under 18 cannot be in a contract because they're not of legal age to make these decisions. That's what the law says. So if a person who is 15 enters the contract by themselves without their parents' permission to buy a car and they fail to make the payment, then that contract is null and void because they were never in a position to make a legal binding contract in the first place. So when it comes to marriage, marriage is a contract. And under most states, that contract is not recognized to exist between people of the same sex.
Got it. Well, thanks for clearing that up because I really didn't know what Obama, you know, did by showing some support. I didn't know if it was illegal.
No, it's been
a measure, or was it just a morality thing?
It was a symbolism of support for those people who are gay, but also, and very much the same way with the NAACP. My concern, and this was just pointed out before, and I've said this to friends of mine and associates who are gay. What you do, gay, straight, in between, whatever, you're not hurting man, woman, and child. That's you. My concern when it comes to civil rights activism is I don't see you, gay people, when it's time to push towards something that is deeply involved with racial justice. Yet, what structures were put together with blood, sweat, and tears by black people to create racial justice by law, those laws are used by others in their advocacy. Yet there is nothing given back. There's no money given back. There's no physical support given back. So my thing is, and I've said it to people to their faces, I want to see you after you leave the gay rights parade, come over to the black parade in the Black Protest March and help us out instead of waiting until we challenge and we push and we create headway when it comes to justice, and then taking the laws that we've created and use them for yourself, giving us no attribution, no financial support, and no support in our protests around it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just leeching off of us, and it's not right. And there, you know, people will say in a minute, just like the Black people, we're just like the Black people. Well, if you think your quest for justice is just like the Black people, then come over to the Black people and help us out.
I can understand where you're coming from. Now, I know you probably never met Martin King, but what do you think he would stand, Thurgood Marshall, on this issue?
On the issue of, I think it's very provocative for the people of their time, but I also think that both Thurgood Marshall and Martin Luther King would have realized, when it comes to people's rights, how will their expansion of rights or the negation of their rights affect the rights of Black people? And that's why you have to kind of look beyond something that you might not feel or one might not feel comfortable with and realize that if this group is denied their rights, how is that going to affect us with our rights? That's why they use the progress we make as Black people. They don't mean, a lot of these people don't care about Black rights. Just because you're gay doesn't mean that you are racially sensitive. I mean, I know two gay people gay males who are quite racist, if you ask me. So it's not that one is going to give you the other, but the law, now that it doesn't have race on its face, if you restrict the laws for certain groups, that can come back and bite you. And that goes back into something that we've slightly discussed before, which is the laws around the Muslims and what's going on with anti-terrorism. Because the laws that are put in, what people think of that are just going to be applied to Muslims and anti-terrorism and all of this, which is very, you know, troubling, can turn around and be used against anybody. Because it doesn't say Muslim on the law. People are creating these laws based on terrorist fears, but those laws can come back and be used against Black people protesting for their rights and just call them terrorists.
Right. So it goes back to Martin Luther King's famous saying, which is injustice, a threat to injustice anywhere is a threat to injustice everywhere, something like
yes,
that.
Yes, and that's just you've got it. So we may or may not feel certain ways about gay rights, but we have to look at it. If nothing else, look at it from a legal standpoint. If we negate the rights of certain groups, the negation of those rights can come back and harm other people. And too often, we selfishly and short-sightedly look at just what we think is going to be in our unique best interest. And we can't look at it that way. We have to be able to realize that laws that are created that might harm other groups can then be applied to people who we never thought it would be applied to when the laws were first enacted.
Okay. So where do you want to go next? Do you want to go to Trayvon Martin, or do you want to start with Stop and Frisk?
Well, all of it can be under the headline of oppression.
That's why the show is titled The Gist of Freedom. So if you want to get down to the bottom of how do we maintain this freedom that we fought so hard for? And do you think that we're losing ground as far as liberties?
I think so. And I'm concerned because I'm not naive enough to believe that if we leave other people alone, they'll leave us alone. One of my sayings is this is Earth, and Earth is filled with earthlings. If you want people to be good and just and fair, then that's when we get to heaven, and then we'll have all that. But while we're here, it's a dog-eat-dog world. And I don't feel like being eaten. I think that the problem is people are so used to bad things happening to Black people. Now, let me say that again. We are used to bad things happening to Black people. So whenever situations like the Trayvon Martin case happen, if you change that around and say, make Trayvon Martin Irish and change it around a little bit, people are shocked. They're stunned. They think it's horrible. But as long as it's a Black person, it's like, yes, it's sad, but, you know, things like that happen. Let's move on. Let's look for forgiveness. Kumbaya. And my concern is we're so used to bad things happening that we've almost begun to become numb to our own oppression. And that's why it's so important to realize freedom is important. Freedom is what we're fighting for. We've kind of lost sight of that. And we also have to visualize what our freedom would look like. What would it look like to be free? You know,
right.
To be able to walk the street freely and raise your children freely. And what would a good education look like? You know, what are we fighting for? What is the goal? We're so much reacting to bad things that happen that we lose sight of what it is we're fighting for. So right now, stop and frisk, we want to fight against stop and frisk, but we also want to know that we want to be able to sense freedom and walk down the street. And when we have a problem, call the police, but not look at the police as the problem.
Whoa, that's heavy. I wanted to ask you quickly about, you mentioned how we've been desensitized with black people being expected to be in this position of misery and downtrodden. Do you think things have changed since the Rodney King beating, which was televised, you know, all over the world? And now the sound of Trayvon's last scream for help. Do you think there's a difference in the sensitivity level that Americans, you know, have for our plight? And we can even go back to Emmett Till with his pictures of his mutilated body.
I believe that it's different. I don't believe that it's... Here's my concern. It's not that there isn't sensitivity, but there was a time when the shock of the oppression suffered by black people at the hands of white terrorists made international news because it was shocking. And because television did not allow for us at the time when it was new in the 60s, it did not allow for us to become numb to the shocking news. So when you saw the image of Emmett Till, it was horrific, and it's still to this day, and it's in my book. That's one of the pictures in my book, actually, the Emmett Till photo with his mother smiling, and then the photo of his mangled, mashed, distorted face in the coffin. But I think television, news, movies, et cetera, videos, as well as the hip hop. Unfortunately, that has made people numb to what it is. If you're going to have a music video with people getting shot and everything else and singing about it, then what do you want the world to say?
By design? Do you think the FCC has permitted this by design? Because there was one time Ricky and Lucy couldn't sit on the same bed together.
Well, I think it's because society has become more numb. And one thing is, look at it from the standpoint, people, we want to feel a certain sense of empathy for us. Those people are going through their own problems. You know, the murder rate in the United States is very high compared to other industrialized countries. So those other people who are not black are experiencing violent crime. They're experiencing unemployment. They're experiencing assault. They're experiencing poor education. So this is happening across the board. So how do you wake people up and say, oh, but our struggle is worse? So I think one thing you pointed out, though, what should the response be? And my feeling is we need to be taking better care of ourselves. Freedom begins at home, and the push for freedom begins at home. We cannot expect other people to treat us better than we're willing to treat ourselves. And I strongly feel that what is happening with George Zimmerman is horrific and must be addressed. We cannot allow people to treat us any way, you know, take away our lives, take away the lives of our children, make us fearful to walk the streets. I refuse to live that way. No one should be forced to live in terror, because that's how it was during the time of lynching and Jim Crow. Black people were afraid to live their lives, and that's the way some white folks want us to live. And they make no bones about it, that that's the kind of society they want us to live in, one in which we are afraid to exercise our constitutional rights and afraid to live in freedom. That's going on with one struggle. But at the same time, we cannot internalize such a level of self-hate that we begin to hurt each other and ourselves, because all we see around us, black people hurting each other, black people being hurt. So we cannot afford to bring that into our minds or our emotions and act out on it. And that's happening too often, where we're acting out on the negativity that we've absorbed from the world. And so we need to fight the good fight against people who want to oppress us, and we also need to be fighting at home to make freedom a reality and make our lives more positive and not internalize the negativity that other people want to say or say about us and make us act out in ways that is part of that negativity and fulfills their destiny of saying, see, that's why we treat them the way we do.
Because I got it loud and clear. So what role do you think the church has played historically in doing the things that you say we need to do? And what role are they playing currently?
Well, I think the role currently is sad. I think it's sad. I think, you know, the church is involved a great deal with real estate. And once again, as I said, there's real estate in heaven. We'll all have beautiful houses there. But, you know, right now, when it comes to my ever-loving soul, I need a church that's going to be focused on soul saving as well as, if must be, real estate. And so I think it's important for our clergy to understand that they have to take a risk. And no one wants to take a risk right now. Everyone is really running scared. And, you know, we have to have courage. And we don't really talk about courage. We don't talk about the people, as you pointed out in earlier cases. There's a reason why it was Reverend Lowry and Reverend Martin Luther King. You know, in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, you had an institution, you had a building in which to meet, which is a church. You had an institution that was respected within the black community. You had leaders within that institution. So you had a whole structure set up for progress, for freedom. And not every minister was on board. Not every minister was, you know, forward thinking when it came to pushing for civil rights. But many of them were. And right now, you really don't have that forward thinking. You don't have that push for civil rights. But I think it's also the core is not visualizing freedom. We have to be able to visualize what our freedom looks like. And that way we can then start talking about what form it should take and then what measures we need to create that form of freedom. But without
it was just in the news.
Anywhere.
It was just in the news 2 days ago, almost 2 days ago, that Creflo Dollar, whose form of freedom is the almighty dollar. He, I don't know if you read about it, but he was accused, it looks like he was arrested for trying to keep his daughter from going out at 1 o'clock in the morning to a party. Did you read about it?
No, I missed that.
Okay. Well, the point is, you know, he's having a problem within his own home, and he's known for pushing that our freedom, our top agenda should be as church folks, to be as rich as he is. Yet, you know, everybody can't be a minister. But how does that compare to some of the first, some of the first revolters? Weren't they all, many of them, that caused revolutions, part of ministry, preachers, and weren't they outlawed and banned from going back to slave territory if they were free?
Well, yeah, I mean, when you think about it, Nat Turner was a preacher. You know, Nat Turner was one who didn't drink, he didn't curse, and from what I've read, and he's one of the subjects in my Race, Law, and American Society book. And, you know, and it speaks to Denmark Vesey and others who had spiritual movements. But also, initially, people who were enslaved could gain their freedom, Africans could, and the Native Americans, could gain their freedom if they converted to Christianity. And so there were those who converted. But then after a while, the religion was used to oppress. And so the religion that was used to oppress was taught that God said that black people...
But that wasn't the true religion. That was a tampered religion.
Well, that was in tampered interpretation. I mean,
right.
Because all this is about interpretation. And so
right.
This interpretation was used to oppress. And so there still were. And then, of course, there were uprisings. And those uprisings sometimes were discussed during church meetings or meetings
right.
of people coming together for worship. So then those were outlawed. So when you go through, you begin to see that there were people engaged in religious work, like Sojourner Truth, for example,
mm-hmm.
engaged in religious work, who were also engaged in advocacy. Somewhere in the last, say, 35 years, that advocacy split off to, and it did not just in religious terms, but it split off in many ideas of advocacy, where the advocates went one way and people who had, you know, ulterior motives, you know, were there, but they didn't have a sense of advocacy. I mean, their idea was to, you know, go in a different direction. But that was in place before, because with Booker T. Washington and his idea versus W.B. Du Bois. And, you know, the idea that, you know, there was, you should make whatever life you're going to make where you are, you know, or as Booker T. Washington would say, cast down your buckets where you are. And
but he didn't
mean
that you need to remain there.
No, he meant grow a life where you are. Don't leave the farm. Don't try to integrate, you know, other groups. Just be the best you can be where you stand. So there are those who don't want, and I won't say Booker T. Washington didn't want to rock the boat, but he really didn't. He's not known as that advocate where W.B. Du Bois was. But Booker T. Washington was not known as an advocate who pushed white people for integration or pushed for additional rights. You know, he was somebody who, of course, founded Tuskegee Institute that became Tuskegee University. And he was very well known. He was a prominent black man during his time. I've read his book several times, Up from Slavery, but he was not one who pushed for social, you know, rights or economic rights. He was one who said, okay, build your castle right here and don't try to push white people for things because they're not ready yet.
And he did push them. I think he pushed them to the extent that he got their money to build over 5,000 schools. So I think he didn't really want to push them into sitting on a bus, you know, next to him or eating in the same restaurant. But he really looked towards self-reliance.
Yes,
he didn't see freedom as being accepted by white people. He saw, like you mentioned, that freedom started at home.
Yes. And so that's why I'm saying you could have a Creflo Dollar who believes the way to have freedom is to have economic freedom at home and not push for, you know, rights. You could have. I'm not sure what his philosophy is when it comes to civil rights or
right.
social justice or anything like that. I mean, I think he's well known, as you pointed out, as somebody who pushes for economic freedom through money. So, you know, if you have economic freedom, then you have freedom and to do other things. And there are a lot of people who believe that. I understand and I accept we should have economic freedom. We should. We should not rely so heavily on other people to make our, you know, monthly, weekly bills. Because
mm-hmm.
once that's taken away, there are people who have lost their minds because they've lost their jobs and their job was their identity.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to understand that economic freedom has its place, but it's not going to stop a George Zimmerman from
mm-hmm.
doing what he did. This is where things get mixed up. You know, that economic freedom and like buy the car and the house and all those things, but at some point you've got to leave home. You know, at some point you've got to interact in the world, and what they see is a person of color. So you may have graduated from this prestigious school. You may have all of this money in the bank. But if you are walking down the street, as Trayvon Martin was that night, they're not going to know any of those things. All they see is an intruder, an interloper, who has dark skin and therefore you are a problem that needs to be eliminated.
Okay. Now let's slow it down, and if you can, recap as if this was the first time anyone has ever heard of Trayvon Martin and Zimmerman, and just take us to where we are today.
Well, we know, or we should have recognized by now from the press, that Trayvon Martin was shot by George Zimmerman. That is a fact. George Zimmerman is considered a white Latino. They say that his mother's from Ecuador and his father's white. Trayvon Martin is an African American from Miami visiting his father. And he was visiting his father in a gated community in Florida. And as he was walking home, you know, he was walking home alone. It was starting to rain. He was wearing a hoodie. He put the hoodie over his head. George Zimmerman called and said that there was someone suspicious in his community. He had worked as a volunteer in the community and watching the community and in the neighborhood watch patrol. He was not working as a neighborhood watch patrol. That was something that someone said that came out that needs to come out again at trial. And it was at this point when George Zimmerman interacts with Trayvon Martin that George Zimmerman decides, even after he's told, to leave the person alone that he thinks is suspicious. He is told to back away. He confronts Trayvon Martin, and it's not known at this point who had the upper hand, who struck whom, but George Zimmerman was carrying a weapon, and he shot Trayvon Martin through the chest and killed him. Now, there have been witnesses to some of it because it was raining. A number of people did not see everything. Some people heard part of the screaming. Trayvon Martin did call his girlfriend and was talking to her, saying someone was following him. And so he was upset that somebody was following him. George Zimmerman was told to leave, you know, the person who would become Trayvon Martin alone. Trayvon Martin lay, I think, 3 days without having his body identified, with the Sanford, Florida Police Department not really doing a good search to find out where this young man was from, just assuming he was an interloper trying to rob something. George Zimmerman's video was shown when he entered the police department. That was leaked out and showed him without any blood. He claimed that Trayvon Martin attacked him, was banging his head on the sidewalk, and broke his nose, but there was no sign of a broken nose, no sign of any blood. And that video was shown. A special prosecutor was given the case. The special prosecutor and the judge all agreed that George Zimmerman would be allowed to leave on bail. And now George Zimmerman has been rearrested because it was found he lied about the amount of money he had on hand. He has a website with a PayPal account in which people have not only given him hundreds of thousands of dollars for the defense of his case, and this is his second attorney that he has working on the case. But in addition to that, George Zimmerman was in hiding because he feared for his life. And unfortunately, the charges against him are going to be difficult to prove because the witnesses have been talking to the press already. The Trayvon Martin parents and other family members have been talking to the press as well. So a number of things have been said that will be used against both sides during the trial. The trial date has not been set, but George Zimmerman has been rearrested for lying on during the bail hearing.
Wow, that's a lot. So you're saying that it's going to be a hard case to prove?
I think it's going to be difficult all the way around, and the difficulty is there were no real witnesses, eyewitnesses, to what took place as far as who attacked whom. And, of course, the core issue that I need to add is that Florida has a law of stand your ground, which allows someone who is fearful of their life being taken to protect themselves by any means necessary. And that is what George Zimmerman said. He was afraid for his life that Trayvon Martin attacked him, and he was defending himself. And so it was an issue of self-defense when he pulled up a gun and shot Trayvon Martin.
Okay.
And Trayvon Martin is 17, and George Zimmerman is 28.
And the weight, the body?
Yes,
the
and it, yes, and Trayvon Martin is a teenager, slightly built. And George Zimmerman at the time was a hefty man. He's lost a lot of weight, you know, under the pressure of having taken someone's life and having, you know, trying to put a defense together, et cetera. But they've also shown, and they're available on the Internet for people who want to see them, pictures of graffiti, racist graffiti, anti-Trayvon Martin, people who are supporting George Zimmerman because they wanted a black person to be killed. They want to support the idea that one black person down and how many more to go. The N-word has been used. I mean, a number of people have made it clear that they are supportive of killing black people.
Now, weren't there reports that even the Zimmerman character, he also used some racial epithets?
Yes, that he used racial epithets when he was on the 911 call.
Right. And how could he say he was fearful if they told him to stay away? I don't think that should be hard to prove.
Well,
he couldn't be fearful. If he had a gun, and he was told not to pursue Trayvon, you know, how fearful can you be? And you're much bigger.
Amadou Diallo
did
not receive justice. Remember the police officers who shot him in cold blood in the foyer of his apartment walked away and acquitted. Sean Bell Chase, the police officers walked away and were acquitted. So right now when I say it's going to be difficult, you can have everything looks like it's right on his face, but we'll see, you know. I think when I was on your show before and people said, oh, you know, we're making progress, I was like, we've got a long way to go. And I still look at it that way. The other point is that the prosecutor's office did release the documents in the case, which is highly unusual, and I'm not sure why this prosecutor chose to do this. But the prosecutor released a number of documents, you know, in this case. Some of them have been redacted, but most of them are documents that you can read online.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a case of another young lady who's trying to say she tried to evoke the Standing Your Ground law when she shot up in the air, and it didn't work in her favor. They sent her off to jail.
She was married to an abuser who actually said he was abusing her. He wasn't killed, but she shot a gun because he was following her. She was cornered in the garage. She remembered there was a gun in the glove compartment of the car. Because she couldn't get the garage door open, which meant she had to go back into the kitchen through the garage door that led to the kitchen. And that was the only way she could get out of the house, or she would have been trapped in the garage with him beating her. And so in order to get him back away from her, to make him back off, she fired the gun in the air. She's a very good shot, I read. So if she wanted to shoot him and kill him, she could have if she wanted to hit him. But she just wanted him to get off of her. So she fired the gun in the air. He backed off. The police were called. The police arrested her for firing this weapon. She said she was standing her ground. And they said, no, they don't agree with it. And she was sentenced to, I believe, over 10 years.
Now, there has been some reports that she was visiting his home, and that she left the scene, and he called the cops, and they had to arrest her, not at the house, but somewhere else.
Well, either way, he even admitted that he had been beating her and that he believed she wasn't going to shoot him and that he did not want charges filed, and they filed them anyway.
Right.
And it's the same person, the same prosecutor.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Interesting. And with this stop and frisk, how does stop and frisk connect with Trayvon's case? We went on and talked about, you know, various cases with Booker T, you know, educational system. How does all this, you know, how can we
have this conversation today and make sense to the audience. And why are we talking about four different things with four different generations when it comes to liberty? How are they all connected?
They're connected under the word oppressor. And one way to oppress people is to make them fearful to exercise their rights and to limit their freedom. So on the one hand, you self-censor yourself because you'll say, I cannot do those things because if I do those things, there'll be an injury, there'll be something that'll happen that's negative, so the person doesn't exercise their rights. On the other hand, when people do finally decide they are going to stand up and exercise their rights, there are those who attempt to oppress them in ways and to intimidate them out of doing so. So stop and frisk and all these other elements of intimidation are there to make life miserable for black people so that they're fearful.
So they're really violating our constitutional rights, the one that says we need to have the right to pursue happiness. How can we be happy if we're in constant fear?
Well, that's actually in the preamble, so that's not one of the rights. What the Fourth Amendment is the right I'm thinking about. The Fourth Amendment provides for the right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures by the government. And so in Terry versus Ohio during the 1960s, we had, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court decide that it was not too much of a price to pay to be publicly humiliated as long as the police and the general public felt that they were safe from those who were carrying these concealed weapons. So in cases of imminent danger, law enforcement is allowed to stop and pat down people to look for concealed weapons. And now it's been from imminent danger as a standard to whenever law enforcement feels like doing it. And whom is the target? Of course, people of color, because they feel those targets are vulnerable, that those are the targets. It's going to be their word against the police departments, and people are going to listen to the police. They're not going to take the word of people of color, especially young black males. And the New York City Police Department actually stopped and questioned and frisked over 600,000 people in 1 year. 600,000.
So they are criminalizing people. Is this a way to fill up the jail system? Is this, you know, we had a guest on some weeks ago, Sam Pollard, director of the film documentary Slavery by Another Name, and they had to, after slavery, find a way to re-enslave us, and it was incarceration. Is this, you know, this the prison system is very lucrative, and it's responsible for union jobs. It's responsible for a lot of police officers getting overtime. So is that a factor to keep money flowing by locking people up and criminalizing what would necessarily be innocent people? It takes a lot of paperwork, manpower to process all those stops, right?
Yeah, but and this is a time period when crime rates are down.
Mm-hmm.
So crime rates are down, and they have been down over the last 7 to 10 years, and yet incarceration is up. And one of the major issues is not just the money that's made, because think about all the money that could be made by black people and other people of color, Latinos, who are being able to contribute fully to society.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. It's also oppression. So they get to make money and limit the freedoms of other people and limit the competition that would come from black people who would be fully realized in their potential. So when you limit that competition, and that's what happened after slavery, because, you know, slavery was the one time of full employment for black people. And as soon as slavery was over, there was unemployment for black people. And so you had full employment during slavery, unemployment after slavery, because now when you had to pay somebody for these jobs, they then are in competition with the white people doing the same work. And in order to limit that competition, that is to take people out of the workforce, out of the marketplace, and put them in prison. So you not only make the union jobs, the other jobs that you noted before, you up with the prison industrial complex, but you also take away competition that would make these white people have to work harder. And because the other people, Asians, for example, are treated the same way, So there were certain laws for Asians, certain places Asians would. It's no coincidence it's called Chinatown. That's where they had to live during certain time periods. But also, when Chinese were competing against whites in the 1800s, when they brought over the Chinese after slavery and the Chinese were doing the work that we used to do, they also said, oh, we don't want you here anymore because you're working for a lower wage than the white people. So you're a competition. We don't want the competition. Therefore, there's only one law on the books from federal law that actually spells out a particular racial group that was not allowed to become full citizens, and that is called the Chinese Exclusion Act, where they actually said Chinese cannot come into the country anymore. Those who are in the country cannot become naturalized citizens, and they have to be treated in a certain way.
Wow.
And that book, that law stayed on the books until the 1900s.
Terrible. What's the difference between what's going on in Arizona and the stop and frisk that is going on in New York?
Not a whole lot, and that's another example of watching to see what laws are created with other people in mind. They don't say so on their face, but they have other people in mind that can then turn around and be used against us later. So the U.S. Supreme Court is going, and I cover the U.S. Supreme Court as a journalist, and I was actually planning on being there. I was in Washington, D.C., Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of this past week, and I plan on being there, you know, several times over the next 3 weeks, because this is when the U.S. Supreme Court decisions are going to be made on the Arizona immigration case as well as the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, what's going to happen, I think, with this case is that if you take it and say police are able to have the power to stop somebody they think is in the country illegally, ask them for documents to prove they are here legally. And if they don't have those documents, lock them up in jail until they find those documents. This country has no citizenship database. So how do you prove you are a citizen? And while you're attempting to do that from inside jail, somebody has to run around to find a birth certificate or something, and it's another way in which we are now harassed. So they can take anybody. Any black person, my family dates back in this country 300 years. They could take me, put me in jail, and say, prove you're a citizen. So the same law they put in place for Mexicans or whomever, Latinos, they could use for anybody else, namely African Americans, in another way of harassment. And the Supreme Court has already decided that while a person is in a jail precinct, they can be strip searched. Strip searched.
Mm-hmm.
Washed down. In the news, with police officers and everybody watching, this could all happen to someone while you're in jail. And all of this is taking place right before our eyes.
Wow. Now, this reminds me of the my favorite case of 1850, the Fugitive Slave Law. What's the difference between the Fugitive Slave Law of Arizona and a stop and frisk?
Well, let's say what the similarity is, oppression.
Mm-hmm. But they all are about someone being an eyewitness determining, like even with Homer Plessy,
mm-hmm.
you know, they wouldn't allow black people to sit in a streetcar if they had this one drop of blood. So it was up to a citizen to determine if you are a illegal immigrant, if you are a fugitive slave, a runaway slave in the North. Now, it was Zimmerman's case, if you are a threat to society, I can shoot you. You know, so all of these things you say are oppression, and it seems like they're cycling, and they're coming back with different names, but they all have the same
game.
They're
coming back, but they resurface, but they never left.
Right.
And that's why it's so important for people to know their history, to understand that you have to keep fighting for freedom. You have to keep fighting for and visualize what that freedom is. You have to be a part of the process of maintaining our standards and goals. This thing of keeping it real, what does that mean? You know, you're going to keep it really oppressed. I mean, it's like what is happening here is I didn't make this world. I've inherited it, and I write about that. We've inherited the world we're living in. And as I said, there's a heaven, and this isn't it. So this place, we need courage, we need struggle, we need to understand there's an investment that must be made, and that investment requires us to know our history and use whatever talents we've been given. We all have different talents, and those talents have to be used to maintain progress.
Well, you are a dynamic guest, and that's why I keep asking you to come back. And what makes you even more special is that you not only talk a good game and actually do it, but you don't just get people all riled up with the facts. You have a place where they can go to act out on the things that they learned about. And so I want you to tell the audience before you leave the name of your organization, where you need volunteers to be vigilant to keep our freedoms and our liberties.
Well, the Law and Policy Group will be publishing the report on the status of black women and girls. It's the only ongoing report on the state of black females in America. My book is Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to present. It connects the dots between the laws that oppressed us before and the oppression that's taking place today. Although the laws may not be on the books in the same way, but the oppression remains. And I would ask people to become weekend warriors. These weekends are valuable. Yes, this is the most free time we've ever had as black people, but let's not abuse the free time. Let's use it in the talent that we have to build our own businesses, whatever it is, large or small. If you grow things in the backyard, if you iron, cook, clean, whatever, fix cars, babysit, we need to maintain those businesses on the side, and we need to be weekend warriors, because those people who worked in the civil rights movement were not called community activists. They were called people who cared, and we all need to become people who care. And even if that's just a few hours on the weekend, we need to do that to maintain our progress and freedom.
Now, what if someone wants to invite you to be a guest speaker?
Then, that's fine. I would love to. As a matter of fact, I'm speaking in Illinois next week. Well, this coming week, I'm speaking in Illinois for Juneteenth, for their Juneteenth celebration. And so if they would like me to come and speak, they may reach me at 212-237-8407. 212-237-8407. They go on the website of Law and Policy Group. They'll see an email address, info@lawandpolicygroup.org. info@lawandpolicygroup.org. So there are ways to get in touch with me. Once again, 212-237-8407, and that's my number at John Jay College, and I'm an associate professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City.
Wonderful. I can't let you go without you explaining what Juneteenth is.
Oh, Juneteenth. When Abraham Lincoln was president during the time of the Civil War, he made a decision that he would free by proclamation the enslaved Africans in the South. In that way, it would undermine the economy of the South. It would also provide the Union soldiers with more men to help fight for the North. Without those black soldiers, the North would have lost. That is a fact. And without those black soldiers, the South, of course, suffered. And it suffered because there was no one on the plantations to do the work. So without those black men on the plantations suffered. And so the word of the Emancipation Proclamation that was from Lincoln's freeing of the slaves was slow in getting there, but finally arrived in different parts of the South. Because, of course, the whites in the South didn't want to tell the slaves that they were freed by President Lincoln. So the date they kind of say is sometime in June. So they're not sure what date in June, but they say sometime in June the slaves were free in 1863. So that is Juneteenth is what they're saying, is that what they're using. So there's no particular date, but they claim June, sometime in June, so they call it Juneteenth. And so the Juneteenth celebration is one that celebrates freedom. So the gift of freedom will be celebrated in Waukegan, Illinois, on June 16th by me. I'm the keynote speaker at that Juneteenth festival.
All right, Gloria, thank you so much. I held you up a little longer than what you expected, but I appreciate you being a part of the show.
and we'll talk soon.
Okay, thank you. And once again, thank you so much for having this show and for giving me this opportunity.
Okie dokie. Bye-bye.
Bye.